From Public Health Institute, welcome to the PHIC-EC Global Health Podcast, a podcast that highlights stories from the PHIC-EC Global Health Fellowship Program, a U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention funded program implemented by the Public Health Institute. Our fellows are guided by CDC Global Health experts and work on the front lines of global health, developing the technical and professional skills needed to make meaningful contributions to today's global health challenges. I'm your host, Whitney Hall, the Program's Administration and Communication Specialist. Our guest today is Dr. Janelle Wright. Janelle started at CDC as a fellow years ago. She's worked all over the world and now is a mentor to a fellow on our program. She is based in Guatemala and is the regional director of the Division of Global HIV and Tuberculosis for CDC Central America, which is part of CDC Center for Global Health. To mix things up a bit for this episode, the fellow Janelle mentors, Christine Gutierrez, is kicking off this episode to talk about her experience with Janelle as a mentor.
So my name is Christine Gutierrez. I am the PHI fellow supporting the Central America team of the Division of Global HIV and TB. Janelle Wright is my mentor, and I've had a lot of mentors in my life, and I have to say Janelle is definitely one of the best. She's just exactly what you'd want in a mentor. She's considerate, she's motivating, she's generous with her time and her energy. I feel really fortunate to have her as my mentor during this fellowship. Janelle is an excellent leader, which I think is something that sets her apart from other mentors that I've had. Once you come up with an idea and you talk to her about it, there's really no stopping you. Janelle is the definition of where there's a will, there's a way. And that determination is infectious and it makes you feel like you can do anything. And I know that's something that I'll take away from this fellowship and apply to the rest of my career. Janelle is the type of boss that pushes you to be the best you can be. She'll give you opportunities to go outside of your comfort zone, sometimes way out of your comfort zone. And that's been a bit challenging for me. But with those challenges, I've grown a tremendous amount in this year. With a mentor that 100% believes in you, I think you take chances that you wouldn't normally take. And that leads to outcomes that you wouldn't normally get, right? So I wish everyone had a chance to have a mentor like Janelle. This experience has been life-changing in many, many ways, from moving to Central America and working with such incredible professionals. It's all been great, but one of the biggest impacts has definitely been Janelle as my mentor. So, yeah, I hope from her interview we can learn and continue to learn. She has so much wisdom, so much, you know, experience that we can learn from, and I think she's really, really just one of the best mentors out there.
So maybe we get started with what your current role is at CDC in Central America and how long have you worked with the agency?
Sure. Thank you so much, Whitney. And it's great to be on the podcast. I have to be honest and say this is my first podcast, so I'm very excited about that. So I started with CDC back in 2008, and I started as a fellow. And at the time, it was a different organization that was providing the opportunity for fellows. And I actually went straight to Vietnam and I worked there for 2 years as a program management fellow, mostly working on system strengthening and public health institutes and working with them. And then I stayed on actually for a couple of years as a contractor, working in the whole country on system strengthening and human resources for health. And then from there, I moved to Central Asia. I went to Kazakhstan. It's right below Russia. For those of you who are trying to figure out where that is, it's actually the 9th largest country in the world. So fun fact for the day. And so I got based in Almaty, Kazakhstan. And I was covering the whole region. I started out as a COAG manager, cooperative agreements. And then I became the deputy director in the office, and then I was the acting director for several years. So just kind of moving right up. And I was working there on HIV activities in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and limited in Uzbekistan. And so that provided me a lot of work for about 5.5 years. And then from there, I actually moved to a position with USAID in Ukraine in 2018 to 2019, working on system reform. And so that was a little bit of a different career trajectory for me, but very exciting to work on health systems and reform there in Ukraine. And then I came to Central America, based in Guatemala, covering all the Central America countries. And here I've been, I just got here in October 2019 and had about 4 or 5 months before the pandemic started. And then I've been in Guatemala since then.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You've really had a truly global experience. What sparked your initial interest in public health or global health? So how did you, you know, initially get started in this field?
When I was in high school, I loved chemistry and biology, and I thought, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to go and save the world. And I don't know if all high schoolers are like that, but I definitely worked really hard to try to figure out how I was going to get there. So, and I loved everything that had to do with serving people. And so I spent my summers working in mobile clinics and in hospitals in Central America. I worked in Honduras and in Guatemala. And I remember calling my mom, and I was complaining to her about how we were seeing the exact same diseases over and over and over. And I just said, if I could just go to those communities and teach them how to eat better, or how to, come in for their, antenatal clinic tests early or whatnot. I think it was a very idealistic question, but it was a frustration because we were seeing the same diseases over and over and treating the same thing. And so my mom, I remember her response. She said, "Janelle, have you ever thought about public health?" And I said, "I have no idea what that means." And she said, "That's when you look at the population and look at different interventions that you can do to help people establish a better population health, not just individual health." And from then, I thought, "This is what I have to do. I have to go figure out what this is." And so from then, I had, at that point, started a degree in pre-medicine and biology in college. And so I finished that out. And before deciding on going to medical school, my mom encouraged me, both my mom and my dad encouraged me to take a year and figure out what I wanted to do. It's very wise words from them. So I went to Ecuador, Malawi, and Guatemala in a year and started working with HIV, and just fell in love with how much work, I didn't fall in love with the work necessarily, I just fell in love with the field of public health, to be able to help people on a larger scale, to do interventions that made a difference at a population level. And also for HIV, being able to really bring hope and dignity to vulnerable populations through getting them linked to care, getting them linked to treatment, managing their disease progress, and then on a whole, bringing some support to vulnerable populations, such as migrants or the poor or whatnot. So I think that got me on the right path to start my master's in public health. And then I did my my master's degree, and I did an internship in China because I thought, okay, I've worked in Africa, I've worked in South America, I need to work in Asia. So I went to Western China and worked in a university for a couple of months and got a totally different perspective on public health, which was great. And I think from there, I got very interested in Asia. And then I, after I finished my master's degree, I applied for fellowships, and I got this fellowship in Vietnam. I remember sitting in a class in grad school, and we had some speakers that came, and we were having lunch with them, and I remember sitting next to this gentleman, and I asked, he was from CDC, and I asked him, how do you get a job at CDC? And he said, I remember him looking at me, he was on my left, and he looked at me, and he's like, Janelle, you need to find a fellowship. That's how you get into CDC. And I was like, all right, that's what I got to do. So I applied for a bunch of fellowships, and I had no idea, to be honest, that CDC was working overseas. But I knew that I wanted to work in, you know, the biggest public health organization in the United States, which is CDC. So what was great about that is that, yeah, they had this fellowship that placed fellows in CDC offices around the world. And so I was really excited to be placed in Vietnam. And so, yeah, that's how I came to work at CDC, is I started out as a fellow.
That's great. Yeah, it's really interesting to hear your path and how you ended up with CDC. I'm curious, since your mom suggested public health in the beginning, does she come from a public health background or a health background at all?
Yeah, that's such a good question, Whitney. So my parents did development work. I was actually born and raised overseas. And my mom is an occupational therapist, and she worked with vulnerable children in many of the countries that we lived in. And she would, do occupational therapy things. I'm not exactly sure exactly what those things are, but I should know.
Yeah.
But she was helping them with, getting with fine motor skills and whatnot. And then my dad is an electrical engineer, and he was working with small hospitals around the world, putting the electrical design together. And so my parents come from my parents had a service-oriented life, and I think that rubbed off on me quite significantly. And so I think that they were exposed to a lot of different fields of service while they were working. And actually, they're still working. So I shouldn't say that while they were working, but they're still going.
Thanks for sharing. It's always interesting to hear about kind of how people find out about public health, because it's such a broad field. Are there any field experiences in other countries or regions that stand out to you as highlights of your career? I know you've, talked a little bit about being in, Kazakhstan and Vietnam and all these different places. But I'm curious if there's any specific stories that really stand out in your career so far.
The one that stands out to me, and I would say that there are several, the biggest one is the people. I've worked in 4 country offices now, and the local staff in each of those countries have been unbelievable. They've brought me into their homes. They've counted me as family. And I think that's just something I never anticipated in going into this work. I would normally, when I was thinking about this question, when you asked, I would go straight to, the successes that I've had or the things that I've been able to see in my work, but I'll mention those. But the biggest thing is the relationships that I've built, the family connections, and I'll say family because they have become family over the years, and just the ability to connect with so many different cultures and find myself belonging to each one of them, and still belonging to my own culture and my own family. But I would say that is the biggest highlight of my career and will always be, is the people. And I would say as I leave each place that I go into another place, it is the people that are the lasting relationships that you have, the lasting impact that you have is the relationships. I remember I hesitate to say any of these because I have so many of these experiences, but in Tajikistan, there's a laboratorian, and she is one of the most kind, loving individuals that I've ever worked with. And her parents live in the northern part of Tajikistan, where we had an intervention site. And anytime we went up there, her parents would invite me into their home and call me their daughter and feed me so much food. And I'm a vegetarian in a place where they love meat. So they looked up all the recipes on how to modify all of the food to make it vegetarian. And they would sit and we would, you know, laugh over my Russian and my poor Russian. And they would teach me just things about Tajikistan and their way of living. And we come from different religions, we come from different backgrounds, but there was always that connection. And every time I left their house, I felt like I belong, you know, I belong to a family in Tajikistan. The same thing in Kyrgyzstan, where some of the staff brought me in to help me learn how to make their traditional plov, and so I could make it for my family back home. And then, you know, just recently here, it's been difficult to gather because of COVID, but I was able to attend a family birthday party with a local staff member, and just their openness to me. And as I left, they said, "You're part of our family now." And so I think that's been a highlight of my career, if you allow me to share that. Just to underscore how important that is to me and something that will continue to, you know, keep me going. I did my dissertation on Project Echo, which is a virtual learning and mentoring program that was started at the University of New Mexico. And in 2015, I was approached by Laura Tyson at CDC. She was running after me after a session at headquarters. And she's like, "Janelle, have you ever heard of Project Echo?" And I was like, "Laura, I don't have time for this. I need to go." And she's like, no, I think you would like it. So we sat down and, you know, Laura helped me introduce me to this program that allows healthcare workers to connect virtually and maintain a virtual community of practice that really changes lives, not only the provider's lives, but the community and patients as they, as the providers connect weekly on Zoom. And now we're in this like weird world of Zoom and everything like that. But before the pandemic, this was a really new initiative to connect providers weekly and help them share experiences and disseminate new information to them. And so I did my dissertation on the impact of Project Echo on the HIV epidemic in Kazakhstan. And I think a highlight of my career was just going through the data and realizing how much this program had provided a connection for providers so that they felt inspired and motivated to transition patients to better schemes of treatment, how to provide mental health services to them, how to manage their co-infections, and just seeing how the epidemic started to change because providers were equipped with the right information, and just how excited they were to participate in that. So I think that was that's been a big highlight. Another one was just a few months ago in July, actually July 7th, as I remember, I stood on the tarmac of the airport in Guatemala City watching an American Airlines flight land. And then I was just overwhelmed as vaccines came off of that flight, 2 million, to provide vaccines to the Guatemalans. And it was in that moment that we were suffering from a really, really significant and deadly wave of COVID-19 during the summer in Guatemala. And just as those, 4 million doses and for over 2 million people. And I just thought this is going to bring so much hope to the people of Guatemala. And I had provided a lot of support in arranging that that vaccine donation with the White House and the Ministry of Health in Guatemala. So it was unbelievably satisfactory to see that. And then I was able to go to some sites after that and see the doses actually get put into arms and see the faces of the people that it changed. I mean, they went from being scared to having hope that they won't die from this deadly disease. And that's an incredible moment to see the faces. And I guess most recently, this was actually just a couple of weeks ago, we started a new initiative in Colombia and Peru a couple of years ago to bring HIV services to Venezuelan migrants who are living in Colombia and Peru. And, you know, in Colombia, the government has opened up the opportunity for people to come from Venezuela and get services and get what would be close to citizenship actually in Colombia, but it's just not going fast enough. And with the COVID situation and with an overwhelming amount of Venezuelan migrants coming into Colombia, the government doesn't have enough support to be able to support all of them. And so through our support, we've been working with an organization called Aid for AIDS based out of New York City, actually, but they have clinics all over Colombia. And we were able to talk to some of the people who are receiving these services. And I think I just get chills thinking about it. They were talking about how much they had lost all hope because in Venezuela they don't have antiretrovirals for HIV. They knew they were going to die. And so their last ditch effort was to come to Colombia and seek services. And as tears rolled down their face, they were just overwhelmingly, you know, saying thank you, thank you, thank you for providing the support, because if not, the Colombian government doesn't have enough antiretrovirals to support us. But through your clinics, we're able to get on treatment and go from being almost dead to, you know, being able to find some work to support our families or just to keep on living. And I remember this one lady, you know, she was infected with HIV and came to Colombia, and she looked at me and she said, you know, my life isn't worth living, but I just keep on trying. And she got treatment, and through that treatment site, they continue to reinforce to her that her life is valuable, that she is, you know, worth, her life is worth living. And I was so proud to be providing support with that organization that would provide dignity to a lady that, you know, there's millions of Venezuelan migrants, but for that woman, it changed her life. And hopefully for many, many more, it will. And so I think those are moments where I know the road is going to be long to try to continue to get support for those kind of programs. But that was a highlight to know that these services that I've worked hard to establish have changed lives.
It sounds like a lot of your work is getting people access to care, whether that's HIV or medication to treat HIV or COVID-19 vaccination. Is your work kind of split between those two right now?
So my main work is on HIV and TB, but, you know, working in a CDC office overseas, you kind of work on whatever comes your way. And so there was a lot of need to work with issues related to COVID-19. And so I stepped in and helped with vaccines, trying to get syringes into the country to get those vaccines and arms. And then, you know, in Guatemala, we have many, many, many programs, not just HIV. So there's an awesome opportunity to work in a lot of different areas, but mostly I do work on HIV.
Well, I loved what you were talking about earlier too, with relationship building in different countries. I'm curious how many languages you speak, but I'm also, just interested in, you know, in other lessons you've learned working in the field of global health that kind of, you know, whether that's relationship building or communication or other things that come to mind. I'm sure that, you know, there are lessons that apply to various countries that you've worked in.
I think that's so intuitive that you saw that. I am an extrovert, so I love to talk, and I love to connect with people. So learning languages is really important. So I grew up hearing and speaking some Spanish, and then when I went to Vietnam, I studied Vietnamese, and was good enough to order in Vietnamese and travel. And then I did work, like, the last two years, I was able to read PowerPoints and to understand what was going on in meetings. Vietnamese is not for the faint of heart, let's put it that way. And then when I was in Kazakhstan, I learned Russian. And when I say I learned Russian, I really studied it very hard, but it is also a very challenging language. And so I would say by the end of the time that I was there, I could have basic conversations and communicate. When I was in Ukraine, my favorite thing that I would do is memorize speeches. And so I gave speeches in Ukrainian. I would just memorize them. And I think that was I loved seeing the faces of people, like, who is this American woman who is speaking Ukrainian? And then I thought, oh, if they come up to me afterwards and try to speak Ukrainian, this is going to be a challenging conversation. Uh-huh. but I think it's true. You know, it's such an important part of connection with the culture, or there's ways of saying things in another language that give you insight into the culture and how things are. You know, in Vietnamese, there's 7 different ways of addressing somebody depending on how old they are and your relationship to them, and that's so important compared to English, which is just you. And then the same in Russian and in Spanish. There's the formal, informal, and those are just really important to understand as you navigate the international space. I think beyond that, I reflected when I think it was like in 2018, I came across a speech by Bill Fagy. He was giving a commencement speech actually at Emory, and he said, "You cannot imagine what will be invented in the future. You cannot imagine the opportunities that will be presented. You enter a world of infinite possibilities, confusing ideas, continuous changes, but a life plan will limit your future. Instead of a life plan, spend your time developing a life philosophy, and then you will have the tools to evaluate every fork in the road. What is truly important to you?" And I think until that point in my life, I had been trying to say, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this. And so I think a big lesson for me has been, don't develop a life plan, develop a life philosophy. And that truly has provided me a way forward in many of the different decisions that I make in my life. And my life philosophy is influencing to provide hope and dignity to vulnerable populations. And so anytime that I've made a decision about a job or things to invest in my time, I think, is this something that I can do to influence so that I can actually bring hope and dignity to vulnerable populations? And a lot of things get filtered out. A lot of jobs get filtered out. And because there are opportunities that come up that provide that opportunity to do that. And then there's opportunities that come up that don't provide that opportunity. Even though they might be really great opportunities, they just don't align with that life philosophy. So that's been an enormous help to me. And I would absolutely encourage other people to do that, to bring clarity to your life and to bring clarity on decision making. And just kind of into that, knowing your priorities. I think a lot of people talk about, well, I've had to sacrifice this in order to do this. And I think getting into that language is really dangerous because it's actually priorities over other priorities. And I think it's a natural thing in life when you do this over that, you're prioritizing one thing over the next. And so by prioritizing being overseas, I know that I'm, you know, not going to be able to see my family every weekend, or that I will have to speak a different language or not get as much of a salary or benefits or whatnot. And I think it's important to know those priorities and to own those priorities. I think another big lesson that I've learned is public health equals change. And change is hard. People don't want to change. I want to keep on eating my peanut butter every day, but I know that is not the best thing for me. But that's a lot of times The uphill battle that we face in public health is asking people to change, wear a mask, get vaccinated, etc., you know? And so we find ourselves, why don't people want to change? Like, I think it's just managing your expectation that this is a field in which we are trying to help a population that doesn't necessarily want to change, to change. And so having that expectation is really important. I think the other thing in that is that a million people will tell you everything wrong with your ideas. And if you know it's the right thing to do, you just got to go for it. You have to keep on going. There's a lot of people that are, you know, want to keep the status quo, keep the programs as they are, don't change. And once you bring clarity to why and how things can change, I think you can bring a lot of impact and influence into those spaces. Another thing that I've learned is things aren't always what they seem. I learned this lesson early on. I was in Vietnam and I was with our country director, Michelle McConnell, and we were in a meeting with Vietnamese Ministry of Health. It was not going the way that I thought it should be going. And she just kept her cool. And in the middle of a conversation, she's like, thank you very much for meeting with us. We'll get back to you. And, you know, we'll be in touch on our next meeting. And I like looked at her and I thought, wait a second, we haven't agreed to anything. This is not going the way that I thought it was going to go. And I was kind of angry, actually, in the middle of our meeting because it wasn't productive. It wasn't efficient. All things that I really want. And then after the meeting, I was able to talk to her and she gave me all the context on what was going on. And just, I learned so much from her on being kind, being humble, being respectful. And that has kept with me since then. Her modeling of that was enormously impactful on my life. Another thing that I've learned, pay attention to the tension. When you're feeling tension, pay attention to it. And when you're overseas and you're working in a different culture, in a different language, with different values, it's important to understand what's going on. And so there's going to be, you know, things that don't seem right, or there's going to be times when you feel exhausted and you don't know why, or you feel like the communication isn't right. Pay attention to that. And what do I mean by that? It doesn't necessarily mean having long conversations or whatnot, but just checking in with yourself. Why is this feeling off? Why is this feeling not right? And a lot of times it's, you know, you're burned out, or you're, you know, there's a mental health thing there, or maybe there's a gray line that there's not a specific clear path forward. And so taking time to do more research or taking time to ask more questions is important. And then I would say paying attention to resentments that you might have. And so people talk a lot about work-life balance. I like to talk about quality of life, actually. And because everybody has a different life. Some people who have a partner and family at home, or they might have older family members that they're taking care of, or pets, or other things. And it's important to make sure that that you know what are those things and the priorities in your life that provide quality of life. And maybe that's, you know, loving your job and loving working hard, and you don't have to be ashamed of that. Keep on going. But maybe part of that is you need to take some time and spend with your mom or your dad that needs some support, and not being ashamed of that. And that's part of it. You know, I started at the beginning of the pandemic. We had meetings every single morning that started at 6 a.m. because we're 2 hours behind Atlanta. And I really started resenting those. And I thought, why? I love working and I love working hard. And I thought, oh, because I have to give up the time that I work out. So I love running and lifting weights and, you know, just working things out, you know, in the morning, physically. And I realized like I wasn't able to do that. And so for my work-life balance, I needed to figure out how I was going to manage all of those morning meetings and be able to get in my workouts, and not resent, that these meetings were encroaching on my life. But you know, other than that, I, you know, people were like, oh, you know, do you get asked to do more work because you're single? And I was like, no, I love working. I want to work harder. A lot of times people have to tell me not to work so hard, but I don't mind it, you know. But there's certain things in my life that I pay attention to because those are things that are really valuable to me. I would say along those lines, establishing habits has been unbelievably important. I have like a 2.5 hour routine in the morning. That seems like a lot, but if I do that every single morning, it sets me on the right path. And I do it even when I'm traveling, so that every single morning I do the exact same thing, whether I'm traveling, whether I'm at home, whether I'm on vacation, actually, I do it every morning. And that's been built up over the last few years, but it keeps my energy, the what I want it to be, and it keeps the clarity in my mind of why I do what I do and what it looks like to do that for the day. And then I guess just going back to what you started with, Whitney, is connection and belonging are the root of success. And so finding those ways to connect and belong in a foreign country that maybe religions are different or values are different or language or ideologies or whatnot, there's still those moments of connection and belonging because we're all human beings, and those are important to continue going. So I would say those are the biggest lessons that I've learned. And I hope that, you know, some of those things will maybe answer other questions that we have today.
Yeah, definitely. That was great. Thank you so much. I mean, I think a lot of what you said speaks to having a strong sense of self, so self-awareness, but also being open to learning and reading other people and having that flexibility. So I think that that's all really great advice, and I'm sure will be helpful for people listening. You are a mentor to one of our PHI CDC Global Health Fellows, so changing directions a little bit, Christine Gutierrez, who's based in Guatemala. So I'm curious to hear what qualities you think help fellows make the most out of their fellowship, especially since you started at CDC as a fellow. And then how do fellows contribute to your work and your office division mission and goals?
So if everybody could be like Christine, that'd be amazing. Conversation over. Let's move on, right? No. You know, I am very different from Christine, and I have learned so much about what I should have done as a fellow from her. And one of those things is that she is patient, much more than I would have been. She, when I think, oh my goodness, I haven't provided her enough clarity, I haven't provided her enough direction, she has patiently waited to kind of figure things out and observe and listen and read, ask people. And but she's also been super patient with me. She sends me very clear emails that are no more than 4 lines usually, and with a very clear yes or no sort of thing, so I can work with her. But I think that would be a big thing, is that for the fellows to know, is that not all mentors know what they're doing. Unfortunately, we're kind of all in this together, trying to figure out how to work on this. But I would say it's helpful just to know that in general. But yeah, I would say that Christine has been an incredible example of how to move into space. I mean, she came on and she was virtual for the first 5 months. We never even actually met each other, but she joined us every single morning for our daily check-in. And she learned, she wrote down things. She pored over PowerPoint presentations that were probably outdated in some ways, but she kind of pieced it together. But we also spent time together talking, going through her goals and objectives, and she would write things and then we would edit it and make sure that she was going in the right direction. So that was really helpful. I think a big thing for fellows also is to know that you are a big part of the office. No matter how much you think that you're just a fellow or I'm just over here, energy is contagious. And so your energy that you bring to any meeting, to any email, to any communication is contagious, and everybody, you know, the local staff are watching, the U.S. Direct Hire American staff are watching, and partners are watching, and they're paying attention to the energy that you bring. And so just being careful about that, being knowing how you're showing up. I will say I'm super thankful that, you know, we have an opportunity to be on camera a lot so that I can see people, and that's a big part, and just showing up the way that you really want to show up. And then I think a lot of fellows are coming from directly from school, and where, you know, assignments are clear, you know what's expected of you, you turn it in, you get feedback, and you move on to the next thing. And this is a very different environment where feedback may not always be given to you, or you don't know exactly what is required of you or whatnot. And that's part of the tension as you move forward in the first year of your fellowship, is just knowing that the pace is a little bit different, the feedback loop and the expectations are different. Deadlines are sometimes fudgeable, you know, if it's not due today, it might be due tomorrow, or whatnot. So I think those are just being flexible in that way, I think has gone a long way to just being successful as a fellow. And I think if I have some opportunity just to speak to the mentors, I don't know if they're listening, but I would say to the mentors, you know, take time to delegate tasks. These are highly, highly skilled fellows that have done an incredible job in their education, and they're coming into a new work environment. So be patient with them, but also, like I said, take time to delegate responsibilities, but not just responsibilities, authority. You know, be very clear on who has the authority to do what with those responsibilities. And then be clear on who makes decisions. Are you making decisions? Is the fellow making decisions? Can they work autonomously? Can they work with you? Are they working with other people? The other thing that I would say to mentors is this is a training program. It's not just another way of employing people. And so taking full advantage of that is really important. Providing opportunities for training, so going to conferences, whether that's virtually or in person, or allowing them to take turns working with different programs or different interests, is super important to the development of fellows. Connecting them to different people within CDC or within other organizations, I think, is part of the fellowship and the spirit of it. And then I think with feedback, I would just say, you know, reward what you want repeated. When you see fellows doing something that you really like, and be very specific with that, acknowledge it. Thank you for writing that email like that. Like I said, like Christine writes very short emails because I've rewarded her for that. I said, thank you for writing me short emails with very specific outcomes or decision points. And then, you know, I've seen instances where, you know, the relationship with the mentor and the fellow isn't going great. And I think for both, it's more of like you get what you tolerate. And so if you don't talk about it, or if you keep on sweeping it under the rug, it doesn't necessarily always get better. It a lot of times just gets tolerated in some way. But the way to do that is individually talking with them. And so, you know, if you... your fellow is coming into a new position, they're coming into a new fellowship and a new way of working. And so they're bound to make mistakes or do things that you wouldn't necessarily do that way or whatnot. And so taking the opportunity to either pull them aside or to say, you know, in a direct email, you know, maybe you could do this differently, or actually this is outdated information. Can you please, you know, use this information? You know, even with fellows, with other employees, that's what I always try to do, is correct individually, but not in front of everybody. It undermines leadership in all directions. And so just taking that opportunity to empower them to correct their mistakes, and to take ownership of those and move on, and helping other people see that, I think, was super important. So I just wanted to say a few things to the mentors out there too, because a lot of times we don't know exactly everything, the right thing to do all the time. So I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, there's so many things to consider with mentorship. Are there, you know, I'm
kind of curious how you learned kind of this, what was important in terms of skill sets to being a mentor. So are there any mentors you have had that have been especially influential in your career?
That's a really good question. I would say the most important mentors that I've had are the local staff in the countries. And they have provided me with all the cultural context and how do I do this and what do I do here and how do I talk to this person about this and whatnot. So, you know, I would name every single one of them if I had time. And you know I would, Whitney. I would take the rest of this time to talk about them. But yeah. I would say, you know, that my more official mentors, Janine Ambrosio was my first mentor in Vietnam, and she took so much time with me to explain everything to me, to promote me. She looked for opportunities for me, and that's how I got to Kazakhstan, quite honestly, was through her guidance and leadership. Irene Banesh is a mentor of mine from the prevention branch at CDC in Atlanta, and she was with me through all of Kazakhstan, and she was one of those people that I could reach out to when anything was happening in the country office and I just needed somebody to talk to and have an outside perspective. And so she would, she's super busy, but she would always take the time, and even to this day she still takes the time in her busy schedule to catch up with me and to talk with me and give me perspective. I guess that, you know, one story that I have is I was in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, and the country director at the time was Mitch Wolf, and he was in Hanoi, and he would come down to Ho Chi Minh City every 6 to 8 weeks. And one time he came down and he's like, "Hey, Janelle, I need you to come with me." And I was like, "Oh, yes, you know, yes, sir." And he was in it was at the beginning of the day, and I went into the conference room, and he's like, "You're hanging out with me for today." He's like, I just want to spend time with you, but I have a lot going on, so do you mind if you just hang out with me and you know, go to all my meetings with me?" And that was one of the most impactful days, just shadowing him. He took me to all his meetings. I heard all of the discussions. And one of the takeaways from that was observing how he made decisions and how he asked questions. And that was something that I took away for many years to come, was just how he was so curious about things. And so that he would make good decisions, and he didn't have a lot of information. He was super busy. And so people would present things to him. He would ask a few questions, fascinating questions, and then he would make a decision and then move on to the next thing. And so I think if you're a mentor, that's one thing that you can do, is just have your mentoree sit in on all your conversations and your work day, and just let them shadow you. And a few years later, I had already gotten to Kazakhstan at that time, and I was in a conference, I think it was in Durban in South Africa, and Mitch was sitting there for lunch, for breakfast. He's like, "Hey, Janelle, come sit with me." So I sat down at breakfast, and he's like, "What are you doing now?" And so I told him, and he's like, "You know, one day you're going to be my boss." And I thought, what? He's like the most important person, right? And his humbleness, but also he just believed in me, you know, and I think that went a long way to helping me have the confidence to keep on going. And he and Chuck Vitek, who was in the Ukraine office at the time, they're like, "Hey, come on a walk with us." So I just listened to them. They were just like, "Hey, you know, come and chat with us." And their humbleness, to allow me to integrate into their world, and to understand what was going on, allow me to observe, obviously has been super impactful on my life, and now where I am today still has an impact on my day-to-day decisions and how I approach work. And just the humbleness that they brought gives me the opportunity to be humble and to allow other people to come alongside of me and you know, to experience what I'm experiencing. And I would say the last thing, Whitney, there's been some mentors in my life that I wouldn't say are mentors in a good way. They were mentors in a really bad way, in that they showed me exactly what I shouldn't do. And those mentors have Obviously, I won't mention their names, but they have allowed me to see how I don't want to be treated, how I don't want to treat other people, what it feels like to be, you know, pushed aside, or what it feels like to be undermined, or all of those things. And maybe I just wanted to give them some credit, right? Because that has also shaped me in how I approach work and life. It's not just the amazing mentors that I've had, but some of the ones that have just showed me, yeah, this isn't how I want to lead, or this isn't how I want to make people feel, and so I'm not going to do those things. I hope that's okay that I shared that.
Yeah, definitely. That's important too. Yeah, I think that's such a good point, and something people often don't bring up is that those challenging times are really like teachable moments. Even though they can be like painful or uncomfortable, you can always learn something. So I think that's, yeah, a really great point to bring up. Well, you have talked a lot about soft skills earlier, but I'm curious what technical skills you think are most important working in global health right now.
Sure. You know, I think it really depends on your interest in public health. There's, you know, when I was at the School of Public Health in Chapel Hill, there was, I think, at least 8 different departments. There's biostatistic, environmental health, maternal and child health, behavior change, health behavior, health education, nutrition, population health, policy, management. And so in all of those different areas, I think obviously it's important to know where you might have strengths and then to go into those areas. I think a lot of people think about public health and they're like, you should have data skills, and you should, and be able to work with numbers and statistics and whatnot. And those are really important to be able to analyze data and look at trends and look at epi curves and those things. And those are obviously really important. I'll give you one technical skill that you may not expect, and that would be a budget. public health is actually a very, very driven by budgets. And so I think if you're able to develop budgets, analyze budgets, execute budgets, and not be scared of it. I remember the first year of grad school, I was like, why am I in this finance class? And I will tell you that that was one of the most important classes that I took in public health school, because after that, knowing how to execute a budget has been unbelievably important. I would also say, you know, for technical skills, just being comfortable with learning different systems, whether that's SAS or STATA, whether that is, you know, the statistical systems. But I think also being able to navigate, you know, some of the dashboards. And as you grow in your leadership and roles, you'll find yourself that you're not doing as much of the data analysis, that you are actually making decisions based on the data analysis. So I think a big technical skill, and maybe people think this is a soft skill, is how you make decisions. So learning how to ask good questions, learning what information you need from where, how to do research, how to read publications, I think are super important to making decisions as you grow in your career and as you grow in your leadership.
Thank you. Yeah, that's all really interesting. You're the first person I've heard say that about budgets, so that's really great to know.
It's unbelievable how much, if you know how to manage your budget, what you can do. And I'll just give you one example. You know, we were doing advocacy for a different system in one of the countries that we work in. And, you know, one of the team members is unbelievable in her technical skills in this one area. And she brought all of the information on the quality of these services and how they need to do it and how the access for the patient's going to increase. And my first question to her was, how much is this going to cost? And she kind of looked at me and I looked at her. She looked back at me. And I looked at her and I was like, I guess we got to figure out, huh? So we brought in our health economist and we did an in-depth cost-effective analysis. And that was able to, he put that together with the data that she had collected on quality and access and whatnot. And we were able to provide a presentation to the Ministry of Health last week on on how this was going to be a cost-effective alternative to what, and when I say cost-effective, it doesn't necessarily mean cost-saving. It's a cost-effective approach to this one intervention. And it was interesting because the person from the Ministry of Health immediately took the microphone and she said, "I have never seen somebody tell me exactly what I need to do like this." She said, "We are often given all the reasons why we should do something for the quality, but I never know how much it's going to cost, so we don't do anything. But now I know how much it's going to cost, and so I have a way forward, because not only is it better access for patients, better quality of services for the patients, but it's actually a lower cost to the health system." And so being able to provide that triad of information to policymakers is unbelievably important.
That makes total sense. I mean, there's long-term costs and short-term costs, and it's really interesting to hear. Well, on top of that, this kind of just is our wraps up our interview, but I'm curious if you have any favorite public health trainings or resources you recommend for people either, you know, with a similar background to you or those who are newer to public health. And then if there's any kind of other nuggets of advice that you have for listeners who are eager to work in global health. I know you've shared a lot already, but just wanted to make that space if there's anything else you'd like to add.
So one of the most impactful books that I've read, and I know I've mentioned Bill Foege, he wrote a book called House on Fire, and it's about smallpox and the response in, I think it was Nigeria. I hope it was Nigeria. Now I'm going to... It was a while ago when I read it, but... but that really helped me understand sort of the history of global public health. And he was... you know, just a pioneer in helping and partnering with countries around the world to help, you know, bring services and access and help stop smallpox, actually. And I think he also worked in TB and some other infectious diseases, and then eventually became the director of the CDC. But the last chapter in that book, if you don't read the entire book and you just want to read the last chapter, I think that gives a lot of just reflections on his career as a public health officer and why it was important to him. That was a really great book. Being able to read journal articles, I think, has been really helpful in the areas that I'm really interested in health systems. I'm interested in human resources for health. I'm interested in infectious diseases. And so I read a lot of the publications and, try to gain, innovative approaches to doing things. I wish I had more specific things. I guess the last thing that I would say, I think that as you grow in your success, make sure that your character develops at the same pace or outpaces your success. And the reason why I say that is Brené Brown, her books have really helped me understand the importance of character. And as you said, Whitney, on self, just self-care and self-identification and knowing the ways to mature. I say that because I see a lot of people that they start working in public health and they're thinking this is going to be such a great adventure. I'm going to go wear a hazmat suit and solve and save the world. And you heard from me, that was what I thought I was going to do. And when I first started out was I was going to go save the world. And that was just the wrong approach. You know, I think that it's really important to make sure that you understand your why and ensure that you have staying power for working in this area. Because like I said, public health equals change. And that's not always easy to continue to work in that area. And so making sure that your character, that your integrity, that your kindness, your generosity, continues to be established as you grow in your career. And so when you get to be the director of, you know, XYZ organization, that you have the tools, you have the interpersonal tools, and you have the character to be able to do that role. And I think we talk a lot about performance, and we talk a lot about the skills that you need to succeed And those are super important. That's why you go to school and get those skills to do epi curves and write publications and whatnot. But as you succeed, as you're really good at those things, you will continue to grow in leadership and be called upon to do really big things. And if your conduct, if you're mean to people, if you are undermining people, if you gossip about people, if you're rude to ministries of health, you won't get the opportunities to continue to grow in your career. And so I guess I would just say that as a final thing and encourage people grow in their own leadership and to grow in their own person, to be able to do all the awesome things that you can already do in public health.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. I feel like so much of what you shared today is applicable not just to public health or global health, but just career advice in general. So,
I mean, a lot of it is. It is just being a good person, in the world. You know, be kind, make good decisions. I end a lot of meetings saying that: be kind and make good decisions.
Well, that's a great note to end on. So thank you so much, Janelle. I really appreciated hearing from you and learning from you. And and appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Whitney. Really appreciate it.
Thank you to our guests, Dr. Janelle Wright, Christine Gutierrez, and all of you for tuning in to the PHICDC Global Health Podcast. This podcast is a project of the PHICDC Global Health Fellowship Program, implemented by the Public Health Institute and its partner Consortium of Universities for Global Health for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Please join us next time as we share more fellowship stories. To learn more about our program and see how we are making meaningful contributions to today's global health challenges, visit our website at phi-cdcfellows.org. If you enjoy the podcast, you can always subscribe or rate us and leave a review, which helps other listeners find the podcast. For questions, please email us at info@phi-cdcfellows.org. This podcast is produced by Whitney Hall. Thank you to Mike Sage, Christine Caraballo, Natasha Alcaz, Stephanie Gregory, Rora Michael, Felicia Warren, CDC Center for Global Health, PHI, and CUGH.